is Tuesday, the 11th of May, and welcome to Korea 24, coming to you from Seoul. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. President Moon Jae-in has requested the National Assembly to send confirmation hearing reports on three embattled cabinet member nominees by Friday. We'll have more in our news briefing shortly. The US recently expressed its support for waiving patents on COVID-19 vaccines to help boost production around the world. We'll speak to the Director General of the International Vaccine Institute to hear his thoughts on this idea. Plus, on Touch Base in Seoul, we have joining us in the studio the newly crowned Korean Basketball League champion and playoff MVP, Jared Selinger of Anyang KGC. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. South Korean lawmakers are wrangling over the confirmation of presidential nominees for three cabinet members after the main opposition People Power Party refused to endorse them. President Moon Jae-in, however, has asked Parliament to agree on confirmation reports by Friday. Joining us to provide details on this tug-of-war and other news of the day is KBS World Radio news editor Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Jang.
So lawmakers are still at odds over the confirmation of three cabinet members, as well as when to hold a voting session to approve the nomination for Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom.
Indeed. The National Assembly failed to meet a preliminary deadline on Monday after the main opposition PPP balked at endorsing confirmation reports for Science Minister nominee Im Hae-suk, Fisheries Minister nominee Park Jun-young and Land Minister nominee No Hyung-wook, claiming they are inadequate, citing their ethical lapses. Opposition lawmakers have yet to agree on setting a date for a parliamentary session to approve or reject the nomination for Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom, demanding that the president withdraw the nomination for the three ministers first, declining to separate the two issues. If the National Assembly fails yet again to agree on reports by Friday, the president can go ahead and appoint the three nominees even without these reports, in accordance with the law on confirmation hearings. However, Moon will have to face criticism of appointing only those who fall in line with his policies, with just a year left in his term. So far, the Moon administration has appointed a total of 29 cabinet members without the consent of the opposition camp.
Yes, the question is whether the president and the ruling camp can afford a criticism as they are struggling in opinion polls lately.
Indeed.
Let's move on and turn to news related to North Korea now. The South Korean ambassador to the US indicated that President Moon will seek a breakthrough in the stalled talks with Pyongyang during his summit with the US President Joe Biden next week. The news came as North Korea has reportedly acknowledged a US invitation to explain the results of its recent policy review. Can you give us the latest?
Yes, well, Ambassador Lee Soo-hyuk told Korean correspondents in Washington during an online news briefing on Monday that South Korea is seeking a turning point in the stalled denuclearization process. During next week's summit in Washington, Ambassador Lee also said that the U.S. consulted with South Korea at various levels throughout the process of drafting its policy review on North Korea and that it incorporates much of Seoul's position. Let's listen to what he said.
이번 정상회담을 계기로 동맹과 지역 안보 차원에서
Maximal efforts are underway to find solutions to long-pending regional issues of the allies at the upcoming summit. We anticipate that the upcoming talks will be the most practical and beneficial to national interests, as well as satisfying to South Korea and the U.S.
Yes, we apologize for the audio quality on that, which was unfortunately not great because it was an event that was held online. Mm-hmm. Now, this comes on the heels of reports that Washington reached out to Pyongyang offering to explain the Biden administration's policy review on North Korea, even as it dots the I's and crosses the T's on that paper.
Yes, and the North also reportedly confirmed it received that invitation. However, we have yet to receive details on that front. Meanwhile, an official with South Korea's Unification Ministry said it positively views the reported hints of communication so long as it provides an opportunity for Washington and Pyongyang to resume dialogue. Still, the ministry official who declined to be identified said on Tuesday that it is too early to jump to conclusions about North Korea's response and that Seoul is keeping a close eye on developments. Ahead of the first face-to-face summit between Moon and Biden slated for Friday next week, South Korean Ambassador Lee also said that his embassy is in talks with the White House and the State Department to try and secure COVID-19 vaccines from the U.S. to head to South Korea before June, amid growing calls for faster vaccination at home.
Meanwhile, the head of South Korea's top spy agency left for Tokyo on Tuesday to attend a trilateral meeting with his U.S. and Japanese counterparts, which will likely focus on discussion on North Korea and China. Can you give us more details on that trip?
Yes, National Intelligence Service Director Park Ji-won will meet with U.S. Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines and Japan's Director of Cabinet Intelligence Hiroaki Takizawa within this week. The meeting, the time and place of which is yet to be disclosed, will likely focus on putting denuclearization talks back on track, as well as exchanging views on the Biden administration's new North Korea policy. Park, a former four-term lawmaker, is also reportedly planning to meet ruling Liberal Democratic Party Secretary General Toshihiro Nikai behind closed doors to discuss contentious bilateral matters such as Japan's wartime sex slavery and forced labor. Park previously visited Japan last November and met Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga, conveying President Moon's overtures to mend ties.
Now, his visit comes as relations between the two nations chilled further on Tuesday after Japan's education minister approved textbook publishers to revise the term military following comfort women in textbooks.
Indeed. Japan's education minister Koichi Hagiuda was suggesting that publishers revise the term, which is used to refer to the victims of Japan's wartime sexual slavery. His remarks came after Japan's Suga said that the Japanese government decision to take military out of the term military following comfort women will immediately be applied to textbooks. This indicates that Suga agrees with right-wing lawmakers' view that the expression military following comfort women is an inappropriate, as it suggests that the women were being forcibly conscripted by the military.
And finally, let's get an update on the pandemic situation here in South Korea. The nation saw the number of new daily infections return to the 500s again. Still, the government is hopeful that the number of COVID-19 deaths and patients in intensive care will drop sharply in the second half of this year. Can you break down the numbers for us?
Yes, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency reported 511 new infections on Tuesday after Monday's drop to the 400s, bringing the country's cumulative total to 128,283. A solid two-thirds of those infected domestically came from Seoul and the greater metro area. Still, the government expects the mortality rate to decline after the government completes inoculating most of its seniors within the first half of this year, according to Son Young-nae, a senior official at the Central Disaster Management Headquarters. He told reporters on Tuesday that the decline will likely allow the government to ease quarantine and social distancing protocols starting July. Meanwhile, South Korea is considering lowering the age limit for the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration lowered its limit to 12. The Administration of Food and Drug Safety currently approves the use of the vaccines for those aged 16 or older. Still, inoculation is currently underway only for those above the age of 60.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
In a surprise announcement last week, the Biden administration said it supports the waiving of patent protections for COVID-19 vaccines. This comes as COVID-19 deaths are mounting in India and elsewhere, and supporters of the move cite it as an important step to quicken the end of the pandemic, especially in developing countries. But critics say the move will not address supply issues, especially of raw materials, and that it could stifle future innovation. EU leaders have also expressed their opposition, saying that the US should be doing more to export jabs that they produce. To help us get a better understanding of the situation, we have joining us on the line now Dr. Jerome Kim, the Director General of the International Vaccine Institute here in South Korea. Dr. Kim, thank you for speaking to us once again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Could you explain for us what is a COVID-19 vaccine patent exactly, and what does it mean to waive these patents?
So the waiver of patents really is the government saying that it will not uphold lawsuits held by the companies against people who violate patent rights. Mm. So, I guess when you think about why the United States is doing this, over the short term, I think the Biden administration would like, as with many people around the world, would like to see an increased supply of vaccines provided. I think that the real question is, over the short term, is this kind of patent waiver going to do anything for that short-term supply? And, you know, as an organization that doesn't hold patents but has vaccines of our own and that is involved in the technology transfer of these vaccines to companies around the world, you know, this isn't something that happens overnight. It takes time. And it's not only the patent, that is the construct of the vaccine itself, but it's the know-how, how to manufacture, how to make the vaccine at high quality. And so it's been said that, for instance, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has 50,000 steps. That's not in the, that may not be a part of a patent. Mm. Individual parts, individual steps might be, but the knowledge itself, the ability to make the vaccine is something that that is a lot more complicated than just the patent.
Okay, so if we just take it a slight step back, if the patent waivers are allowed, would that essentially mean that it would give any pharmaceutical company the knowledge to produce their own vaccines, for example, here in South Korea or in any developing country as well?
Not necessarily. It doesn't mean that the United States government will compel Pfizer to open its books and reveal all its secrets. But what it may say is that companies may be able to reverse engineer the vaccine, come up with a substitute. And it's a very different thing. And so, you know, the way the companies have operated during the COVID-19 pandemic has actually been some of the best cooperation that we've seen between major companies. And what do I mean by that? Well, you know, the AstraZeneca vaccine is made here in Korea by SK Bioscience. It's made in India by the Serum Institute of India. It's manufactured in Brazil by one of the Brazilian companies. The Pfizer vaccine is not only made by Pfizer and BioNTech, but also under contract or by contract manufacturers in China, by the company called Fosun. So the different companies, I mean, we've never seen, for instance, Sanofi, which is a major French vaccine company, make a vaccine for Pfizer. But in fact, that's what it's doing. We've never seen Merck, another major vaccine company, make a vaccine from Johnson & Johnson. Again, that's something that's happening. So the companies have found partnerships with other companies that are known to make high-quality products. And that's the key. What you want is to be working with companies that know how to manufacture high-quality vaccines that will meet necessary regulatory approvals.
Okay, so why is the U.S. supporting this then? What are the benefits of a waiver? Who are the beneficiaries if vaccine knowledge is shared?
So I think, you know, and the two parts of the question are, the first, in the short term, and I explained why I don't think that this will make much difference in the short term. As a longer-term policy, for something that applies during pandemics, is it going to be important to share technology as quickly as possible with groups that can, in fact, manufacture high-quality vaccine in countries that have adequate regulatory regimes in place to ensure that the companies that are making the vaccines within their borders are able to make a high-quality vaccine? Yes, I think it is an important thing in the long run for pandemic situations. For us to be able to count on manufacturing capacity around the world. So I think as a mid to longer term solution, it may be a good idea. But over the short term, it really doesn't accomplish probably what the president intended.
Right. So the challenge is ensuring the high quality of the vaccine in perhaps companies or countries that are not used to making this vaccine. But for a lot of these countries at the moment, there is a supply issue. They are falling behind in their vaccination program. Could this not help at least alleviate that, at least try to help these countries find their way towards creating and producing vaccines themselves?
You know, over the short term, it doesn't. And that's the problem with supply is going to be the most constrained in the first 9 months of 2021. And then gradually, global manufacturing capacity will come online. I mean, I think we've seen that the Sinopharm vaccine, one of the Chinese vaccines, they can make 1 billion doses a year. That vaccine was approved, given emergency use listing by WHO. That should contribute. If another Chinese company called Sinovac has emergency use listing, that would contribute another 1 billion doses to the global supply. So, you know, as we bring online and get approved different sources of vaccines from different countries around the world that are known to make high-quality vaccines that are vetted by the World Health Organization and reviewed, then, you know, the shortage situation will decrease over the short term. Again, over the longer term, strengthening manufacturing capacity regionally, strengthening the ability of the regulatory agencies like the Korea Ministry of Food and Drug Safety to be able to assess the quality of vaccine manufacture is going to be very important. And, you know, I hope that in the long term, you know, we should be able to come to some understanding. But the final part of this is, and it's something that's hypothetical, but potentially could impact things. If you were a small company and you thought that, and there was another pandemic, and you thought that the government might give up your patent rights, would you participate in any program? Would you bring your innovation to bear? I mean, one of the amazing things about the COVID-19 vaccine response has been, you know, we've gotten more vaccines out more quickly than we could have expected. And some of the vaccines, the adenovirus vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, are vaccines for which there weren't good examples before COVID. So it spurred innovation. Could that be lost if companies feel that governments will just give up their intellectual property?
Right. So if the future, if they, for example, worst comes to worst, another pandemic happens, would they be inclined to try and develop one if they feel like their patents are going to be taken away from them after a certain amount of time? I understand there's also some concerns about chasing raw materials that there might be if the patent waivers are put in place, that companies would compete and that there's not enough raw materials currently.
Yes, and so raw materials, particularly the raw materials that meet the necessary quality arrangements that companies have, are going to be in short supply. So, you know, again, as with many things in the manufacturing of vaccines, remember that vaccines are biological products. They're not simply a chemical that you can duplicate. This is something that involves 50,000 steps in living organisms, for instance, in cells, and you have to have a certain set of supplies that go into that meet certain standards. And the production of those kinds of reagents are limiting. And so, again, you want the best quality manufacturing to have access to that so that the vaccines that come out in high quantity also come out in high quality.
So the question goes back to then, how do we help developing countries that are falling behind in their vaccine program? What can be done? EU leaders have criticized Biden's decision to waive COVID-19 vaccine patents and urged them to actually start booting its vaccine exports to help the crisis. What's your take on that suggestion?
There is a global mechanism called COVAX, which is an agreement made by 189 countries that will supply vaccine to all countries around the world that have signed up. So initially it was thought 20%. Now it looks like it will be 30% of the necessary supply up through the end of 2021. We want COVAX to be able to supply 100% of that. So the best mechanism to do that is to contribute excess doses to the COVAX mechanism and not make one-off deals, you know, country to country for vaccine diplomacy or geopolitical reasons, but to really provide that vaccine. And the next part is that, you know, COVAX needs to also begin to prioritize by need so that the countries in the greatest need are given access to the vaccines they need in order to control pandemics. And this has many reasons. I mean, one of them is humanitarian. Obviously, we don't want people becoming sick and dying of COVID-19. There's an economic argument, $4 to $5 trillion of excess economic loss caused by the COVID pandemic if the high-income countries exclusively vaccinate their own populations. And finally, you know, we have a biological crisis, and we know that mutants, these mutant coronaviruses are being generated in the large outbreaks, such as in the outbreaks in Brazil or South Africa or India. And we really don't want those mutants to undermine the $20 billion that we've already invested in developing safe and effective COVID vaccines. So we have to help everyone get the pandemic under control as quickly as possible.
Sure, I'm sure many of our listeners will understand that argument, but high-income countries like the US, they don't seem to be getting on board with that kind of thinking enough, perhaps, that they're not exporting enough. How do you get countries to get on board like that?
This is about multilateral diplomacy and countries coming together to agree upon targets for manufacturing and for distribution of vaccine around the world. Now, the United States has, for instance, indicated that, you know, it has 60 million additional doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. What is it going to do with that vaccine? And how is that vaccine best used? Is it best given to the U.S. Strategic partners? Is it best given to COVAX? Is it best used for geopolitical reasons to bolster the case for the United States and countries around the world? I think that we could make a very strong argument that the better response is to use the multilateral mechanism that prioritizes countries by need, and that the United States, the European Union, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, the countries that have already ordered excess vaccine need to be making plans to somehow begin to share some of that vaccine to allow access and equity for COVID-19 vaccines to countries around the world.
Yes, and perhaps the fact that we are even talking about such a drastic step as waiving patents might give us some hope that countries are preparing to take drastic steps like that as well, Dr. Kim.
Yes, let's hope that this is just the start of a new process that will begin to recognize that countries around the world need COVID-19 vaccines.
Dr. Kim, we will leave it there for today. We've been speaking to Dr. Jerome Kim from the International Vaccine Institute. Thank you once again for your thoughts today.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korean Composite Stock Price Index fell 39.87 points, or 1.23% on Tuesday, to close at 3,209.43. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 14.19 points, or 1.43%, to close at 978.61. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 5.81 against the dollar, ending the session at 1,119.61. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Welcome back. We've now come to our daily segment, Korea Trending. This is where we take a look at some other news stories that people in Korea have been looking up online today. And bringing these stories today is Lee Ju-young, who joins us online now. Ju-young, hello.
Hello, Jung-ho.
So what stories are we looking at today, Ju-young?
Our first story is about a local hospital accidentally misdosing a patient with a COVID-19 vaccine. We then talk about music video director Kwon Sun-wook, who is also the brother of the K-pop singer BoA, battling stage 4 cancer. Our last story is about the country's newest women's pro volleyball team establishing a new home base.
Okay, Ju-young, let's get to our first story then. And you said it's about a patient who was misdosed with a COVID-19 vaccine. Can you tell us more?
Sure. A general hospital in Sejong City accidentally injected a patient who came to be vaccinated for shingles with the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. Sejong City, located south of Seoul, said yesterday that a 54-year-old woman, surnamed Lim, was incorrectly injected with the AstraZeneca by a nurse last Tuesday and suffered from muscle pain. Blood and urine tests found no particular abnormalities, but Lim was reportedly hospitalized for a week.
Wow, that must have been quite a surprise for the patient. But can you walk us through how this happened exactly? How was Im accidentally administered an AstraZeneca shot?
Right. Simply put, the nurse failed to check the doctor's prescription properly. You see, before a shot is injected, nurses typically have to follow a three-step process. First, check the prescription to see what needs to be administered, then check with the patient on what they came to receive, and then check a final time to see if the last two steps line up. The hospital admitted that it was entirely their error. About 130 people reportedly came to be vaccinated for the coronavirus on that day, and the nurse mistakenly thought that Lin was just another patient who came for the coronavirus vaccine.
Of course, nurses and doctors have had a very difficult time over the last year, and our hats go off to them for everything they've been doing for us during the pandemic. But this does sound like it was quite a careless and grave oversight. Could the hospital possibly face any legal repercussions?
Health authorities at Sejong City and the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency said that misdosing drugs alone is not subject to punishment under the law, as no substantial damage has occurred. And the fact that COVID-19 vaccinations are in full swing nationwide has also been the basis for the view that punishment is not necessary. However, health experts point out that if a person who had pre-existing medical conditions had suddenly been vaccinated without proper examination, it could have led to a dangerous situation. COVID-19 vaccinations are typically carried out after carefully examining the recipient's physical condition on the day of to reduce possible side effects that may occur.
Right, and the fact that the patient was hospitalized for a week perhaps shows the side effects were quite strong with this patient. Thankfully, it doesn't seem any long-term harm came out of it, but yes, a concerning mistake in any case. Let's move on to our second story of the day now. What are we looking at?
South Korean music video director Kwon Sun-wook, who is also the older brother of singer-songwriter BoA, revealed on social media yesterday that he is battling cancer. The 39-year-old wrote that he has repeatedly been taking breaks from work as he hasn't been feeling very well since last year. Now, he is looking at only 2 to 3 months left of life if the prognosis is poor due to peritoneal cancer that has metastasized into stage 4. He also added that his weight has dropped to 36 kilograms as he has not been able to eat normally for over 2 months and that his body can't absorb even a drop of water. Kwon said that his family is hopeful that he can recover, but he himself has lost a lot of confidence after seeing his own bodily functions fail him by the day. He also wrote that it's hard to believe his current predicament, as just a few months ago, he was fine and working well.
Yes, that is very sad to hear indeed. Can you tell our listeners a bit about his career as a music video director as well, Jiyoung?
Sure. He is the founder of video production company Metaology and has worked with top Korean music stars like Red Velvet, Girls' Day, Baek Ji-young, and of course BoA. He comes from a very musical family as his little sister is the K-pop phenomenon BoA and his big brother is also pianist Kwon Sun-hwan.
Have we heard anything from his family about his situation?
Yes, we have. BoA thanked her brother for staying strong every day and added that she will one day make Korean ramen for him and that they will eat it together. Kwon's older brother also responded, saying that he's praying that his little brother can get well soon and prove the doctors wrong.
Yes, let's certainly hope so, indeed. Moving on now to the last story of the day. What else do you have for us, Jiyoung?
Gwangju City, which is a major metropolitan area southwest of Seoul, will be the home of the country's newest women's pro volleyball team run by Pepper Savings Bank. A spokesperson for the bank said yesterday that after an in-depth discussion with Gwangju officials, they have decided to cooperate for the development of both the region and the sport. Gwangju City and Pepper Savings Bank CEO Matthew Chong are set to hold an agreement ceremony on Thursday. The new team had been deliberating between either Gwangju or Seongnam, which is located on the southern outskirts of Seoul, which is where the bank's headquarters is at.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit more about the team's approval to the league that was made by the Korean Volleyball Federation, or KOVO, and what this means for the league?
Sure. Last month, KOVO approved the launch of the new club, which is the 7th Women's Squad. It is the first expansion of the Women's Volleyball League in a decade. The federation said that Pepper Savings Bank will receive the top 6 picks in this year's rookie draft and also have the right to nominate 2 special drafts in the following year. The other 6 clubs will also each hand over 1 player who is not among the 9 players protected by the team.
And what was the reason that Gwangju was chosen as their new club's home base over Seongnam?
Mm-hmm. Gwangju City reportedly persuaded the bank with excellent sports facilities like remodeled volleyball stadiums and the locational convenience of Gwangju to operate the bank's other branches. The city even formed a council made up of the mayor, lawmakers, and university professors to attract the bank. The new club will likely join the league in the upcoming 2021 to 2022 season after completing negotiations regarding athletes and other logistics.
Yes, the team caused some controversy last month when they suggested that they could be looking to bring in star player Kim Young-young to the team, but that has been shot down by her team, Hanguk Life, so it looks like that is very unlikely, but it seems they are already causing quite a stir. Mm. That's all for today's stories on Career Trending. Chuyang, thank you for that, and we'll catch up with you again later this week.
Thank you.
That was the moment Anyang KGC clinched the Korea Basketball League Championship last Sunday. They swept the regular season leaders Chunju KCC Aegis, winning four games in the best of seven series. In fact, they swept the whole postseason, posting 10 consecutive wins, the first ever in KBL history. One Anyang player who particularly dominated the court is former NBA forward Jared Sullinger. He was named the MVP of the playoffs, and during the title-clinching game, he scored 42 points. That's half of the team's final score of 84. To tell us about his championship win and his time in Korea, we have now Jared Sullinger in the studio with us today for this week's Touch Base in Seoul. Mr. Sullinger, thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
And it's especially an honor as a Korea 24 staff has been in contact with your team over the last couple of months now to invite you to the show. And we finally have you here with us today, so we appreciate the time you made for us. Now, congratulations on winning the KBL Championship and being named the MVP of the playoffs. Can you tell us how you feel and what was the first thought that went through your mind when you realized that you'd won?
First thought was like, I get to go see my wife and kids. I get to go see my wife and kids
right.
after all the
Who
hard work.
Who are in the
work.
U.S.?
Yes, back in the U.S. So after all that hard work, I get to see my wife and kids and get to hug them and kiss them. But at the same time, I enjoyed it. I really did through the whole process that we went through, you know, with everything that's going on with me and my career and finally be able to win a championship as a professional. You don't get that often.
Mm. And this all happened only after you joined late in the regular season and made your debut in March. But you seem to have fitted into the team effortlessly. What was it like working with this team?
You got to give the players the credit, honestly, players and the coaches. When I came here, I had to fit in with them. Well, so I thought it was more like they was trying to fit in with me and they let me be who I wanted to be. Mm. And, when they did that, it kind of became a seamless transition. And so when you go down the line and you think about, you know, this team, cause we're going to be talked about in KBL history. Mm. But when you talk about this team, you got to give everybody their credit, not just me.
Well, you've personally been given the nickname Professor Seol or Seol Gyosu by your Korean fans because of the way you quote-unquote educate your opponents. What was your reaction when you heard this moniker? Do you like it?
The first thing I heard, when I heard it, I thought about my mom. My mom's a teacher back in the States. my dad was a teacher back in the States at the high school level. So when they told me I was a professor, that's technically a step above being a high school teacher. And so I thought that was pretty cool. And I knew my mom loved it. And she keeps calling me that. I don't know why, but she keeps calling me that. And she thinks she gets a kick out of it.
Maybe it'll stick with you for your future of your career as well.
I hope so. You know, I like to be able to, you know, teach my opponents how to play. And on the same time, I love the game of basketball. I missed it so much.
Yes, you've had an incredible time here. As I said, you joined the team in March. But can you tell us a little bit about your journey to Korea? You had a successful high school and college career in the U.S. before being a first round pick for the Boston Celtics in the 2012 NBA draft, but I understand you've had difficulties with injuries in your career.
Yeah, I had a lot of injuries, back, foot, then back again. So it was just, you know, be able to overcome all that and still win, be able to win a championship and come here. Anyang KGC gave me an opportunity like nobody else did. Everybody else thought I was done after being gone on a hiatus for 2 years. And the head coach gave me a call, and I'm forever in debt to him just because he gave me that opportunity to showcase what I can do. And he let me play at the way that I wanted to play and to help the team win. So, you know, I'm forever thankful for KGC.
That's right. Before Anyang, you were with the Shenzhen Aviators in China, but that was in 2017 to 2018, and then you spent 2 years without a team. What was that period like? Can you tell us about that?
Well, in the meantime, my wife got pregnant with our twins, Jared Jr. and Jim and Marie. And so I looked at it as an opportunity to be there for my wife through all the, you know, ups and downs of pregnancy and just, you know, be by her side. She's been by my side since day one. So it was time for me to return the favor. I just think that's how God set it up for me to return the favor and then get back to the game after the kids got, you know, kind of self-sufficient on their own. And he returned me with a great team and be able to get a championship. So I'm forever thankful.
How did you stay in shape during that time and keep sharp during that time?
I have a great team behind me. I have Matt Weinscott that he helps me with my strength and conditioning. I have my basketball trainer in LD Williams, who recently retired from the game of basketball, now getting into personal training for basketball skills. So I had a lot of people in my corner that, you know, really pushed me to be the best person I can be, and was able to, you know, be the guy that needed to be on KGC to win the basketball game or win a championship. So I'm just thankful for the support system that I have back at home.
Can you tell us about that approach by KGC then? How did that come about, and what was your reaction when they approached you like that?
Well, it was late February. I was trying to hold out and try to get to the G League, but, you know, the G League got closed. I was trying to get to China, but China didn't want me. And then, you know, Anyang KGC came out of nowhere and kind of swooped me off my feet. And, you know, I just wanted the opportunity to play and showcase myself. And they gave me that opportunity. And it came late February, and as soon as they called, I took it.
What was it like returning to the court after 2 years?
Oh, man, it was. I cried before the game.
Oh, wow.
I cried before the game just because 2 years, you know, nobody thought I would be here and then have the opportunity to play again and be able to do something that I truly love. After all the hard work and sacrifice that I put in for 2 years, I was just blown away to be able to step foot on that floor again.
Now that you've won a championship and the MVP, do you think you've made your doubters fear you now?
Yeah, I truly believe so. I just feel like I can get better as well. You know, being 2 years away from the game, I had to knock some rust off. There still was rust out there when I was playing. So, you know, just got to continue to get better. You know, that's one thing I learned about the game of basketball. You can't be the same basketball player every year. You have to come back and you have to improve yourself. You have to add something to your game. And I think that's the goal, is just, you know, go back home, get back into the lab and add something to my game.
Do you think you're back to full fitness now? And are you ready for more?
Yeah, I think I'm back to full fitness, and I think I'm ready for more. I think I truly do, just because, you know, the last, 10 games of the playoffs, Coach played me 40, so I think I'm back.
Right. So you've been tested, and so you know you're back. It was a short time in Korea, though, an odd time as well, especially with the COVID-19 situation, with limited spectators due to all that. What have you made of the KBL, though?
I love it. It's physical. It's fair, and the players, they play hard. No matter, you know, where they're at on the standings, they play hard, and that's what you can appreciate. You can appreciate that because they're not disrespecting the game. It's not like, hey, I'm just ready to go home. No, everybody plays hard. Everybody does their part, and everybody stays true to the game, and you love that.
Was that a surprise for you, how hard they played?
Not really. I had a couple friends that talked to me. Vernon Macklin, Devin Scott, Nate Miller, who played here about 2 or 3 years ago. They all told me that, you know, they play hard. They play hard and they're nonstop runners. And that's exactly what it was. It was an up and down game. Everybody ran hard. Everybody played hard. They played physical. Sometimes the ref let a little too much stuff go. But it was fun. It was really, really, really fun to be out there and see guys really respect the game.
Were there any differences that you saw or any difficulties that you had acclimatizing to the league or your time in Korea?
I just think the physicality of under the rim, you know, what we call a foul in, you know, Europe, maybe even China, in the United States, they don't really call it a foul here. So, you know, you had to learn how to finish through contact. And I think that really helped me going forward is be able to finish through contact, you know, around the bucket, especially around the bucket.
You still dominated during your time, even through all that physical play. And it was perhaps great for the league as well to have a player of your caliber playing here. Do you have any advice for younger players out there in Korea, or even the coaches and management about the game from what you've seen so far?
No, you just got to keep moving the game forward. You know, everything can't be the same way. Sometimes it's okay to think outside the box. And I think my head coach, when I came here, he allowed me to help him think outside the box. And the thing that made him such a great head coach is that he was willing to listen and willing to trust. And that's one thing you have to do as a basketball coach is understand that those guys that's out there on the floor, they see the game a little bit different than what you see on the sideline. They're feeling the bumps. They know where the help's coming from. They know where, you know, the angles to pass. And when you have somebody out there on the floor that you can trust and you listen and you understand, I think that just enhances your coaching ability because you're able to add in what you see on the sideline and add in what the players see on the floor. So it's a little give and take that coach really did with me, and we got the job done by doing that.
If you had to sum up your time here in Korea in one word or one phrase, what would it be?
Amazing.
Amazing.
Simply amazing. That. Just because, you know, when you look at the stats, when you look at the history that we made, nobody ever swept the playoffs. Mm. You know, so when us sweeping the playoffs, they're always going to talk about us and what we did. And that's going to be for a long time coming. I don't see a lot of teams doing that here recently. So whenever you talk about breaking records, you have to speak about Allianz KGC in 2020 and 2021.
Mm. Finally, Mr. Salinger, what's next for you? Would you be staying in Korea? Would that be an option? Or do you have aspirations perhaps to even return to the NBA?
My options are open. My options are real open. But, you know, the ultimate goal is to return back to the NBA. But if that doesn't happen, my options are open. So I'm willing to listen to any and every call.
And just to wrap up then, is there anything you'd like to say to Korean fans out there who have enjoyed your extraordinary performances this year?
I appreciate each and every one of you. You know, going through the 2 years of trials and tribulations of what I went through, I appreciate every one of you just because you've been loyal, you've been respectful, and you've been thankful. And I'm thankful for you more than you even know.
Well, it's been great to have you here with us today. Good luck on your next move. And we're thankful that you came to Korea as well. We've been speaking to KBL champion and playoffs MVP Jared Salinger of Anyang KGC. Thank you for speaking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio. If you ever miss an episode of Korea 24, you can always catch up by downloading our podcast. Simply search for the KBS World Radio app wherever you get your applications from. After downloading the app, select the menu icon in the top left-hand corner. A drop-down menu will then appear from where you can select podcasts, then programs, then Korea 24. There, you'll find a list of all our previous episodes for you to download and enjoy on your own time. And don't forget to follow our Twitter page, @KBSKorea24, to get the latest updates on our show every day.
We've now reached our final closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some features or reports that are coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald, who kindly provide us with their early editions to make this segment possible. Joining me now is our staff editor, Mark Wilson Chair, to tell us about these stories. Mark, hello.
Hello, good to see you.
So what stories have caught your eye in tomorrow's newspapers?
Right, we're going to head to the culture section of the Korea Times. Park Ji-won writes about the passing of the cultural icon of the pro-democracy movement in the 1970s and 80s, who was also the master of the religious folk dance Seungmu, Ieju. She succumbed to cancer on Monday at the age of 73. But Park's piece is less about Yi's death and more about her life and her efforts towards pro-democracy as well as the preservation of Korean traditional dance.
Yes, I understand that Lee Ae-ju was taught by masters of Sungmu since she was about in her second grade.
Yeah.
And in 1996, she became the official holder of the dance, according to the Cultural Heritage Administration.
Yes, that's right. And Park also writes about two key performances that many believe made her become a cultural icon of pro-democracy activism. One was of Park Jong-chul, a student activist from Seoul National University who was tortured to death in police custody, and Lee Han-yeol, another student activist from Yonsei University who was killed after being struck by a tear gas canister. Both were killed in 1987. During Lee's death in particular, Lee Ae-ju's barefooted performance in a white hanok was dubbed Dance to Console the Dead. To read more about her life as an activist, master performer, and a scholar, pick up Tomorrow's Times and check out Park Ji-won's piece.
Yes, it sounds like a great piece in the Times, honouring a very noble figure indeed. Let's move on to our second story now. What do you have for us?
That would be the culture section of the Korea Herald this time, as Song Seung-hyun writes about an art project in Busan that aims to clean up the southern city's beaches. Today, the Busan Cultural Foundation announced a beach-combing project to increase awareness about waste in and around Busan, especially on its beaches and in its waters.
Right, if you've ever walked across a beach in Busan or in other urban areas and tried to pick up trash along the way, it can get quite depressing.
Good for you, by the way, if you do that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, certainly. But you said this is, in fact, an art project, so how is it different than your typical trash cleanup?
Well, Song writes that Busan artists, along with other members of the community, will pick up trash from the beaches, but then they're going to work together to turn it into art. This is actually a form of upcycling when you use discarded materials to make high-value items. We talked about this before. For example, upcycling fashion is becoming kind of a thing these days. The project will run at 5 beaches from May to October, with the exception of July. Artists specializing in woodcraft, ceramics, painting, and macrame will take part. The resulting works will then be displayed at an exhibition in October. So up to 20 to 30 people can sign up at each location through the foundation's website.
Well, it sounds like it could be a meaningful, even fun day out at the beach.
Yeah.
This project may only make a small difference as such, but it serves as another reminder of the issue of waste, especially plastic waste, that we all have to deal with in our current lives now.
That's right.
That is where we will leave it for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you next time.
Talk to you then.
And that's where we bring our show to a close. Thank you for sticking around with us. We'll be back with more news, views and reviews from Korea tomorrow. Till then, we hope you have a great day. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-woo, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.
Back to Heaven by Chun Sang-byung.
나 하늘로 돌아가리라. 새벽빛 와 닿으면 쓰러지는 이슬 더불어 손에 손을 잡고.
I'll go back to heaven again, hand in hand with the dew that melts at a touch of the dawning day.
나 하늘로 돌아가리라. 노을빛 함께 단 둘이서 기슭에서 놀다가 구름 손짓하면은.
I'll go back to heaven again, with the dusk together, just we two, at a sign from a cloud, after playing on the slopes.
나 하늘로 돌아가리라. 아름다운 이 세상 소풍 끝내는 날 가서 아름다웠더라고 말하리라.
I'll go back to heaven again at the end of my outing to this beautiful world. I'll go back and say that was beautiful.
You've listened to Korean poet Chun Sang-byung's Gui Chan, Back to Heaven, read by An Jae-woo and translated by Brother Anthony of Taze and Sun Jae. KBS World Radio brings the beauty of Korean poetry to the world.
KBS World Radio.